Okay, is everybody ready? All right. Well, we will get started here. All right, so this evening we are going to be talking about a book I mentioned last week, Faith Martin's book, The White Chief of Cache Creek. Here you go. This book right here. Once again, I highly recommend this book. This is a fantastic book about Reformed Presbyterian missionaries to the Comanche Indians in Oklahoma, and we're going to talk about it this evening. Megan, do you want to shut the door in your kitchen? All right, so Comanche Indians, let's talk about this. After the Civil War, the next thing that the federal government had to deal with was the Indians. And I'll just go ahead and apologize. I'm just going to say Indians all through this because I'm going to. The Western settlement had really increased since like the 1830s into the High Plains. The tribes who lived there were very unhappy about this. During the Civil War, there was a big spike in raids on settlements in the High Plains by the Indian tribes, and that was because the army was preoccupied fighting with the Confederates. So when the war was over, when the Civil War was over, the United States military turned to pacifying the Indian tribes. So you may have heard of the Red River War, which mostly took place in the great state of Texas. It's kind of interesting, actually. I think you can do a great cultural analysis on the United States by how long it has been since there has been an armed conflict in that state. And if you look at that, then that explains why Texas is the way that Texas is to some degree, because they've had the most recent armed conflict in their state. Red River War was basically the U.S. Army and cavalry went in to round up all of these High Plains Indians, like the Comanches and the Apaches and the Kiowa Indians and other tribes, and herd them onto reservations in Oklahoma where they did not want to go. But the United States Army had pretty much unlimited ammo and food and horses and men, so they were able to just keep going, and eventually the Indians had to surrender and go turn themselves in. In 1867, the government attempted this. This is actually before the Red River War. In 1867, so this is right after the Civil War, the government attempted this, basically trying to use peace, trying to be peaceful to get the Indians onto reservations. So they had the Medicine Lodge Treaty, which basically said, look, if you Indians will move onto the reservations and live there, then we'll give you a little bit of food to supplement your diet of buffalo, and we'll give you some farming tools, and you guys can stay there. We'll leave you alone, and meanwhile, we'll settle everywhere else. And they gave him a lot of land in Oklahoma, mostly. Well, that worked pretty well, except for the fact that at the same time that this was going on, Westerners were systematically killing off the buffalo, right? And what that meant was that every time the buffalo herds would migrate north up into the Indian reservations, there were fewer and fewer of them. And pretty soon, the Indians started starving. So then they stopped staying on the reservations and started coming out again and started fighting. And that was when the Red River War kicked off. In 1887, so this is after the Red River War is complete, is done, and the tribes, especially the Comanches, were the last tribe to really be pacified. In 1887, the federal government passed the Dawes Severalty Act. Okay, Now, this is important for everything we're going to talk about in a little bit, so let me explain this to you. Under the Medicine Lodge Treaty, the government basically said, here's a huge piece of land. It's like basically the state of Oklahoma. You guys can have this land. It's yours. It's the tribe's land. You just have to stay there, and you can kind of do what you want to do there, but just don't come off of the land. The Dawes Severalty Act was basically the way that the federal government came in and said, well, now we're gonna open up the land to white settlement. And the way that they did that was they said, we've given you all of this land. It's tribal land. It's not owned by any individuals. It's owned by the tribes. So what they did was they said, well, we're going to change how we give you land. And instead of giving all this land to the tribes, we're going to give each Indian 160 acres. And wouldn't you know, they gave 160 acres to every Indian, and there was still lots of land left over for all of the white people to move in on. So Reformed Presbyterians took a pretty keen interest in this. You know, several weeks ago when we talked about the history of the Reformed Presbyterian Church, we saw how very early on they were a very loud voice against slavery. They also pretty early on were a pretty loud voice against mistreatment of Native Americans. So you have guys like James R. Wilson, who was a pastor here in New York State. He was pastor, I believe, in Coldenham, if any of you know where Coldenham is. He would write letters. He actually carried on correspondence with Andrew Jackson about treatment of the tribes. So they took a pretty keen interest in this. They wrote a lot about it. You know, Reformed Presbyterians we've always been kind of an opinionated bunch, and don't mind saying things very clearly to people. So here's when the Dawes Severalty Act was passed, breaking all the reservations into those individual parcels of land. The Reformed Presbyterians wrote, "We have dealt with the Indians on the principle we would deal with a wolf. The Puritan method was to steal the Indian's land and shoot him if he objected. The Dutch method was to buy Manhattan Island for $24 and then get the Indian to spend the money for drink. We have taken the remnants of the tribes we have not shot and confined them on reservations. The Indian Agency allowed contractors to rob the Indian on one hand and the government on the other. It has refused to give them rakes and hoes, and has called them lazy because they wouldn't farm." So that, in a nutshell, is how the Reformed Presbyterian Church felt about what was going on. They also saw a crisis for the Indian tribes. Maybe it's a little bit hard to appreciate this, but think about this. You have these Indian tribes who have never really been, they've not been assimilated into American culture, right? Up until just a couple years before, they were riding the high plains on horses, shooting people, and going where they wanted, killing buffalo, making raids, getting attacked by the U.S. military, things like that. But it was a very kind of free, and for a long time, you know, ever since horses were brought over, especially the Comanches, they ruled the high plains. They were the chiefs of the high plains, and so you take this group of people who have a very definite form of culture. They have traditions. They have a way of life, and you take everything away from those people. You stick them onto what to them is a really small piece of land, and you tell them, do something you've never done before, farm. They had never farmed. They were not farmers. And then on top of that, what the Reformed Presbyterians saw as a matter of great urgency was that very soon, because remember, they had been largely isolated from white Americans. They were on these reservations, and the rule was basically like, whites stay out, and the Indians are supposed to stay there, so that they're not mixing, they're not getting in each other's way. But the Reformed Presbyterians saw that very quickly, all of this land was going to be settled by whites. And with that was going to come basically all the social ills that plague white society. And the Native Americans were going to be completely unprepared for it, right? This is the kind of comparable to, you know, sometimes you have people who will immigrate from really rural subsistence farming agricultural cultures, like in Africa, and they'll immigrate to the United States, and they'll be moved into these big cities, and they don't speak the language. Their children are suddenly in public schools, and the parents and the grandparents, you know, the grandparents may never learn to speak English. The parents may learn to speak it a little bit, but they just have no idea what their children are encountering in the schools. They don't understand the culture that they have suddenly found themselves in. Except the difference is that we're not talking about a few immigrants coming to America and finding a world they don't understand. We're talking about people living where they've been told to live and now having the place where they live completely taken over by strangers and foreigners. So this is what's going on. In 1890, around 1890, you also have the beginning of a new religious movement among the native tribes, which I think you call it Pietism. Today, it's still a thing. There's like the Native American Church or something like this, and it's focused on the kind of the core of this religion is eating hallucinogenic cactus and then having crazy visions, and then like sitting around and talking about what you saw. And it has some kind of like Christian themes mingled with it. So this was a new thing as well. They were very poor. Women and girls especially had a very hard time. Oftentimes girls would be married off around age 12. And it was pretty rough. There was a lot of polygamy. Just a little taste of this. It says, this is a few pages into the book. The missionaries were moved by compassion for Indian women. Carruthers, who is the missionary we're going to talk about here in a second, spoke for them all when he reported to the church what he had observed. She is often sold to the man that suits her parents with little or no regard to her own preference. In fact, usually so early in life that she has little choice in the matter. The girls that promise beauty are usually married before they are 12 years old, sometimes at the age of 10. They are expected to do all the work and be subject to the slightest whim of their husband. He's ready to enforce his commands with the whip he uses on his horses. If the wife should be stronger than the husband, other Indians come to his aid. They teach her a lesson in obedience that she will not soon forget. No wonder, then, that their beauty fades almost before its promise is seen. They are old women while still young in years. In the camps, we often see some very decrepit old woman that seems to have passed through awful hardship for a long time. They often impress you with the thought that their vitality has gone years ago, but it is an old battered husk that is in some way dried and moving around, that they cannot realize the abuse they suffer. Yet when we think of the battered body and pity it, we are passing by and forgetting the most precious and the worst abused part of the poor old woman. And then a little later, another woman writes, I think we women are under far greater obligations to our Savior than are our brothers. when we see the contrast between the women in gospel lands and the heathen. It is the gospel that has lifted us to the level of our brothers and allows us to stand where we do tonight. So this is some of the culture that the missionaries were coming into when they came into Indian territory. And you also had basically growing, not sure how to put this. Basically, if you've ever wondered, when did the federal government like beta test welfare dependency? I think it probably happened in the, in these early days on the Indian reservations. They would give them money, they would give them food for free, and then they would wonder why they didn't work. So it was a mess all around. It was a mess all around. A lot of people did recognize that there was a need to try to incorporate these tribes into American culture, but people didn't really know how. Some of you may know down in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, there was a school that was basically, they would take children from the tribes and they would take them all the way out to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, far away from the reservations, and teach them how to be white, basically. We'll get to that later. So in all of this, in the 1860s, the Pittsburgh congregations and the RPCNA decide that they want to join together to organize and try to send a missionary to the Indians. But nothing really happens for about 20 years. In the late 1880s, it's kind of an interesting story at the very beginning of the book. One of the Comanche chiefs, whose name was Itokne, saw the problem of white settlement coming, and he went into the hills and fasted and prayed to the sun that God would send a white man to help them learn how to like live in this new world that was coming to them. And we'll get to him later as well, Chief Itokne. So towards the end of 1888, the RP Mission Board had issued 4 calls to men to serve as a missionary, so 4 successive calls to men to serve as missionary to the Indians, and they were all declined. So this one guy who was on the mission board had an idea. He said, I know, why don't we all spend some time praying, and then without any discussion, we should just all of us vote and just keep voting until we have elected somebody with no discussion. So they all write down the name of the guy they want to call, and they hand their ballots to the president of the board, and everyone except for him and another guy voted for him. and his name was William Work Carruthers, and people just called him Work, which is a pretty fitting name for him because he did a lot of work. So he goes home to his wife. They lived in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, which is like on the edge of Pittsburgh. That's actually like we went to church in Wilkinsburg when we were in seminary. And he goes home and his wife opens the door and she says, "Why are you so pale?" And he says, "They've called us to go to the Indians." And she says, "When do we go?" When do we go? So that was just, and they were like, he was a respected guy. He had a great pastorate. It was in like a nice area. And they just packed up and left. The goal of the mission was, first of all, to bring the gospel to the Comanches, who had never heard it before. I mean, these people had literally never heard the gospel. A second goal was to give them the skills to survive white settlement, to survive the world that was coming on them. In other words, to learn English, to get some education, to learn how to farm, to learn a completely new way of life. They are already out in Oklahoma in the early spring of 1889. So this is like, okay, so it's December 14th today, So he was issued his call on December 18th, and by April they were already out there. Okay, so they just were out there real fast. At this time, the only white people who are allowed out there are soldiers, government school teachers, and missionaries. That's pretty much it. So you could not just be like a random guy in Oklahoma. They were able to get a 160-acre grant, but they had to go find it. They had to go find it. And these surveyors, in preparation for settlement, had gone through and marked off the corners of the 160-acre plots with wooden pegs all over, like, maybe it's an exaggeration, but like all over the state of Oklahoma. So they're out in this like high prairie grass looking for a wooden stake for the corner. There's a great story about how they went to bed. They get out to where they think they want to have, you know, have their property, but they have to find the corner stakes, and they go to bed and they wake up in the morning. So before they go to bed, they hobble their horses, which is where you tie their legs together so they don't run off. And they had two horses, and they wake up the next morning, and it's inexplicably completely foggy. It's like never foggy in Oklahoma. It's completely foggy, and also the horses are gone. So the horses have left like trails through the grass, and the horses also didn't stay together. They like went in opposite directions. So they split up, and they follow the paths to the horses, and each of them finds the horses right next to the pegs. Yeah. So that was how they found their property. Pretty cool. They needed a... Remember, this land is just like completely undeveloped. There are no roads. There's no railway. There's no telephone. There's no anything. It's just land for miles and miles and miles. So they're looking for land that has trees, that has access to stone for building, that has plenty of water, and that has fairly fertile ground, because they expect they're going to have to raise pretty much all of their food. They also want it in the middle of a pretty large, fertile area, because their goal is to have a church there that will be the center of a community where there will be a number of, you know, be a community of Comanches going to church. That's what they're aiming for. It was pretty striking. They go out. They don't know anybody. They're out in the middle of nowhere, miles and miles from anything, and they're like, we're going to build a church right here, and in the future, this is going to be the center of a community where Comanches are going to go to church. So they begin to live there, okay? It is not a very hospitable environment. It's Oklahoma. It's hot, super windy. It can be really dry, except for when it's flooding. So that's kind of what it's like. Wild animals, they spend a lot of time the first like couple years killing rattlesnakes and water moccasins. They like live next to a creek, and they're just surrounded by like animals and insects that will kill you. So they also bring, like, think about this too. They bring their daughter with them. They have one daughter who I think when they go out there is like maybe like 4 or 5. She's real young. So they're out there like they're living in tents for a while. Then they build a picket house, which is basically like, you know, comparable to a log cabin, right? And they're there with their little girl, right? So it's kind of like a Little House on the Prairie, except a little more realistic. They begin building a stone school. They're basically, again, there are hardly any people there except for the Comanches. They need people who know how to build with stone, and they also need people who know how to quarry stone. They end up having to hire, like, drifters, basically. So they hire drifters who will quarry stone, haul stone, and help them build, and they end up building this immense stone schoolhouse, which will also have like the dormitory where the students will live. They begin farming. There's a lot of trial and error here. Remember, at this time, lots of Reformed Presbyterians were farmers. Okay, you got all these Reformed Presbyterians in Iowa and in Kansas and in Nebraska, and they knew all about farming. but they didn't know all about farming in Oklahoma, okay? And as it turns out, they find that it's a little different, and some of the things that work well, some of the crops that grow well back home, don't do very well. Towards the end of the book, they say that they realize, like, this is not really farming land, it's ranching land. And so if you want to be productive, you need to have cattle. That's the only way to really make a living out there. So they are building buildings, managing a construction crew of drifters. They are building a house. They are raising their own food. They get some food from the Indian agents in the town, which they have to ride miles across the prairie to get to through thunderstorms and avoiding, like, creeks that are flooding and that sort of thing. They are 20 miles to the nearest post office and 95 miles to the nearest train station. So they are out there. Eventually, they end up feeding everyone with stuff that they grow, except for a little bit of flour that they get from the government. Well, maybe a lot of flour, but that's pretty much all that they're getting food-wise from the government. They're clothing themselves and children in the school, some with clothing from the government, although that's pretty low quality, but a lot of it comes from churches. So the whole time they're out there, Reformed Presbyterian churches back east will pack up these, like, crates full of clothing or food or all sorts of stuff and send it out there. So there's a lot of stories about, like, going the 95 miles to the train station and finding, like, that there's been these crates of goods sent from churches back east that have been waiting for some time, and so then they have to, like, haul them all out, you know, in a wagon. That's how they're doing it. It's really hard to describe just how hard work Carothers worked. I mean, the descriptions of it is just unbelievable. And on top of this, too, like, everybody gets malaria. And it's the kind of malaria that will, like, come back. So shortly after they get there, Work gets malaria. And for the rest of his life, he has to deal with, like, malaria. He will, like, have really bad chills. And they have several times where they have to, like, real quick, just, like, leave, go back east, get on a boat, go back to the East Coast, and just, like, have a break. But then when they would go back east, all the churches wanted him to travel around and tell him what he was up to, so he got worn out back east, too. He spent a lot of time that first year or so basically just trying to make friends with people. They need to get to know the folks that are around them. So they're far from towns, but there are plenty of Indian camps all around, and they can get to them pretty quickly. They also are trying to learn Comanche. It seems that Apache and Kiowa were a little too hard to learn, even though there were plenty of those tribes around as well. They're trying to get to know the Indian agents. This is a big deal through the book. You would have an Indian agent who's kind of responsible for that area. And he was the guy that was supposed to represent the Indians to outsiders, but also represent outsiders to the Indian tribes. Any contracts with the tribes, like, the tribes would often lease their land to ranchers. So those contracts had to go through the Indian agent. It's kind of striking, actually. At one point in the book, Work Carothers basically says that the best Indian agents were the ones who had fought in the Indian Wars. They were all military guys. So the best ones were the guys who'd fought in the wars, who had fought the Indians. They were the ones who were the most fair, who were the most just, and who protected the interests of the Indians. And it was like the people from the East Coast who had never been involved in the wars at all, who were the most corrupt. It was really kind of striking. So that's kind of the setting, right? You take it all in. They're in the middle of nowhere. They're miles and miles from the train, from the post office. They have very slow or no communication with the outside. They're dealing with disease. They're dealing with snakes. They're having to undergo massive construction projects to build the houses that they're going to live in, to build the school, to build their barns, to build their church building. And at the same time, they're also trying to learn the Comanche language, which I don't think is a very easy language to learn. And it wasn't like there were schools you could go to just be taught Comanche. You just had to pick it up. And they're missionaries. So they're trying to, like, preach to people and share the gospel with people and dealing with all the discouragement that can come with just, like, being lonely as a missionary. So the mission itself, they had, first of all, a school. They had wanted to start the school pretty much as soon as they got started, right? So they were like, this fall, you know, they got there in April, and they had a tent, and they said, this fall we want to start a school, and they couldn't, there was just no way they could do that. They really had to spend like a year and a half, A, building the school, but B, learning the language, getting to know people, getting to know folks in the area. And at first I think they were very disappointed by that. But as time went on, they realized by the time they actually did start the school how important that delay was. So it says that, within a year, however, the missionaries were praising the Lord for all the delays that forced them to get acquainted with the people they came to teach and with the prairie they came to live on before any children arrived. They found that, and again, this also makes sense, they found that there was a certain amount of resistance to them being there. So they had very friendly relationships with many of the Indians who were around them, but it took a while for the Indians around them to be willing to send their children to the school, right? And at one point, I think he even writes back to folks back east, and he says, like, well, think about it. Like, imagine if some, like, foreign culture invaded your land and then started these schools that, like, taught a different religion and then wanted to send your kids to that school. Like, would you want to do that? So it took some time. But one of the dynamics at play here is they work care their saw. And as time went on, the Indian chiefs saw that whether they liked it or not, white settlement was coming. And so it really was a time of crisis for the tribes. And as the chiefs began to see that more clearly, they began to encourage the people in the tribes to go to the school. Okay, and there were other schools as well. There were other missionaries that are around. There were government schools. They had two teachers to begin with, a young Kate McBurney, who's like in her 20s, and Alice Carothers, who is Work Carothers' sister. Carothers really saw that it was important to have a school right there in the middle of all of the camps. Okay, so I mentioned the Carlisle, Pennsylvania school. Is anyone familiar with that, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah. So let me just read this section. So the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, where Pratt's motto, Colonel Richard Henry Pratt, his motto was, kill the Indian in him and save the man. And it says, Carothers had seen the results of off-reservation boarding schools. So he writes, there are about 850 children of school age on the reservation. Many are taken to Carlisle or other government schools, but on their return, drop back into the blanket and paint and are just as much Indians as ever. So long as an Indian, returned from Carlisle, continues in citizen's dress, he is miserable. He stands alone, a target for all the jeer and taunts of the camp. The squaws make fun of him. He cannot get married. And it may be unwillingly, but surely he resumes the habits of his old companions, often excelling them in excess of pain, seemingly anxious to show them that he is as much an Indian as ever. So his goal was basically like, if we're really going to educate these children and help them to change, it has to be where their own people are around them. The other thing that he says, which is really striking, he says, the Reformed Presbyterian goal, which Carothers embraced, was to bring Indians into fraternal relations with the rest of mankind. It was not to wipe out all traces of their culture. I just think that's really striking that, like, his goal was not to, like, make them stop being Indians. His goal was to, like, help them to have a relationship of equality with the wider culture when it arrived. They have a slow start at first. They start with 8 students. They were thinking at first that they could handle 40, and instead they got 8, and they found very quickly that that was enough. That was enough. So over time, they did build up how many students they had, but they started with 8. They taught them English. They taught them Christianity. They taught them the 3 R's. They taught the boys how to farm. They taught the girls homemaking skills. And they also just taught them, like, how to dress, how to behave, how to sit at a table and eat with a fork, knife, and spoon, things like that. At the same time that they were running the school, some of the missionaries would also do camp visits. So they would get in a buggy or in a wagon, and they would just go off across the prairie, find a camp, visit with the Indians there, tell them about the gospel. It's pretty striking, you know, very quickly, the 3 people who did a lot of these visits were 2 of the women and their interpreter, who was a black man. And remember, like, this is just like just a few years ago, the U.S. cavalry was, like, all over this place, and there was, like, open hostilities, and there was shooting, and there was fighting. And then here, just a few years after that, you've got, like, 2 ladies and 1 guy just, like, riding across the prairie in a wagon with no protection at all. They're, like, sleeping out under the stars. It just completely, completely changed. And they talk a lot about how even themselves, they would say, like, we're kind of amazed that we're not afraid to do the things that we're doing. They would go to, you know, sometimes going to the camp visits would just be a matter of, like, show up to a camp, see if anyone wants to talk to you, go into their teepee, and just try to talk to them about Jesus and tell them about God who sent his son to rescue us. Sometimes they would go to these really big gatherings. It might be like some sort of dance that the Indians would put on, or it might be they would have these big beef killings. So when the buffalo disappeared, the government started giving them cattle instead, because they had these kind of, like, ceremonial killings. So they would get, you'd have these, like, masses of Indians would get together, and they would have, like, a whole corral full of cattle, and they would kind of simulate a, like, buffalo hunt. They'd, like, open it up, and the cows would all run out, and then they'd, like, run after them and shoot them all, you know, and then they'd butcher them right there on the spot and eat them. So this is, like, a big event. So they'd go to these as well, and they would set up shop. They would talk to people about Jesus. The missionary work would preach. At the same time, one of the things that they had a lot of opportunity for was medical care. Now, basically, none of these people are trained nurses or trained doctors, but there was so much just physical misery in these camps. They describe some of the girls, when they would bring them into the school, having to basically, like, strip them down, scour them really thoroughly, and, like, shave their heads, and they would have these, like, sores all over their heads. They had all sorts of, like, parasitic diseases and things like that they had to deal with. And just by, like, keeping them clean and changing the sheets and airing out the mattresses and things like that, they were able to vastly improve the quality of life for their students. And because of that, many people from the camps would come to the school, would come to the mission and say, like, so-and-so's sick, can you help? And they would also have some medicine, just like, if I went to your house, you probably have some medicine at your house. And so they would have some medicine, and they would dispense medicine and help people. And it's pretty striking. Let me read this passage about on this topic. Alice reported that the Indians have an exalted idea of the white chief's knowledge of medicine. After the services, those who were sick asked him for something to relieve their illness. Kate said it made her think of Jesus' ministry when the sick and afflicted came to be healed. Carruthers felt sure that the increase in interest in the religious services he was holding in different camps resulted from the recovery of sick Indians he treated. I go every Sabbath to the camps, and they seem more interested than they have in the past. I think one great cause is the blessing that seems to attend our efforts to heal the sick. We undertake anything, and when they get better, as they have in every instance, we recognize that it is not due to our wisdom, but rather in spite of our ignorance. We always pray about it, and some of the cures are little short of the miraculous. And then Faith Martin says, given the type of treatments available at that time, one would probably say nothing short. And it is, she describes in some places like the kind of medicine that they're giving people, and I was like, oh, that's what they use. But that is really striking how like God blessed their desire to help alleviate the sickness of the people around them, and it was effective. They also had to deal with like influenza and measles outbreaks. At one point, there's a smallpox outbreak, and at times, you know, there were like they described one measles outbreak where a government school realized that there was measles among the students, and the headmaster, in a stroke of just total insanity, sent all of the students home. So they all took measles back to the camps, and like 200-something people died. Versus at their school, when they realized that there was a measles outbreak, they basically like shut the school down and quarantined everybody and wouldn't let parents in and wouldn't let children out. And at first, that made everyone upset, as we can all understand, having lived through that. But the end result was like nobody got sick and nobody died. So pretty striking. And then, of course, so you have school, you have the camp visits, you have their medical work, and you have the church. For a long time, for some years, they met in the school, but then they built a stone church. I got to say, you know, like, as we're like thinking about building an extension onto our church building and putting some plans together and stuff, it's a little mind-boggling to me that like this guy who was not, he was a pastor, and yet he just like went out with some guys he found, quarried stone, cut the stone, hauled the stone, and built like a really nice looking stone building. Like, so you can come look at it later. Like, this is the church building. It's a really nice, attractive stone building on top of everything else that he was doing. So reading this book is like always a good kick in the pants for me. It makes me realize, like, got it really easy here in Oswego, New York. The church often used interpreters, right? They're there for the Comanches, and for a long time, I can't remember if Work ever got to the point where he could preach in Comanche or not, but they had several people who were quite good at interpreting. And sometimes they would even, I've seen this happen once, sometimes they would even have it go through two levels of interpretation. So he would preach, someone would interpret into Comanche, and then another person would interpret from Comanche into Apache or something like that. I was at a church service in Africa one time where that happened, and I think the 5-minute sermon took like 25 minutes. It just like took a really long time. One of the things that's really striking is how as the, you know, the children are being taught in the schools, the parents are seeing how the children are growing, and they're living in the schools. The children are living in the schools. So from time to time, the parents will come pitch their tent out in front of the school and hang out, you know, see their children. But a lot of the time, they're not there. They're off living in camp somewhere. But as the parents are coming back, they're seeing how their children are growing. They're seeing how their children are healthy. They're hearing from their children about the gospel, and they're hearing from the missionaries about the gospel, and they're seeing just the deep love and commitment of these folks for their children and for them. And so for those who heard the gospel, many of them were very receptive and thankful for it. Let me find this passage about... So this is a description of like a Thanksgiving service, and it gives you kind of a picture of how the Indians were incorporated into that and their response to it. On the Sabbath previous, Mr. Carruthers preached on the goodness of God. He invited the Indians to join us in a Thanksgiving service on Thursday. They responded so heartily that it was necessary to use the windowsills for seats. One woman leaned too heavily on the window and burst the glass out. You see, we're not getting the new church too soon when we have bursted the side of the schoolroom. After Mr. Carruthers had mentioned some things for which we were thankful, he asked the Indians to tell why they were thankful. They mentioned many things. Almost all of them added some word. But that which seemed to be uppermost in each mind, and that which almost everyone mentioned, was thanks to God that he had put it into the heart of the white man to show them the good road and to tell them how and to pray for them. It is not uncommon in praying for an Indian to mention the name. So like, in other words, when they would pray for the Indians, they would pray for them by name. Takawana said, "When I hear you say Takawana, I know that is me. And I say, give me what he asked for." It's just a really striking, like, when he couldn't understand any of the prayer except his name. And when he heard that, he said he would pray, give me what he's asking for. One of the things I thought was interesting was the hesitancy that they had, some of the Indians had, to being baptized and joining the church. Some of that was because they're discouraged by their fellow Indians. They're discouraged by the medicine men. They're told things like, if you become an Indian, you'll die. Or if you become a Christian, you'll die. You know, if you get baptized, you'll die. But what struck me was two of the concerns they had. One was that they knew that in order to follow Jesus, you need to listen to the Bible, and they couldn't read. And they were concerned that they saw how central the Bible is to being a Christian, and they thought, well, if we can't read, how can we follow Jesus? How can we be sure that we're following him in the right way? Chris?
Were there any Bible translations put into the Indian language?
I don't think that there were at this point in time. Although I know this that came later. What's really interesting is some years in, they bought like a machine for making recordings, and they had one of the guys in the church who was illiterate, I believe, but he had this fantastic memory, and he could just like perfectly retell Bible stories. And so they had him sit down and make all of these recordings of Bible stories, and then they would take those into the camps and play them for people. It's pretty interesting. The other thing that was really striking, another hesitation they had, was they knew that becoming a Christian involves taking vows. And they were really, this is actually why for some of them, the reason they thought that Indians died after becoming Christian was because they were taking vows and then breaking them. Kind of striking. At the first communion, which was like 5 years into the mission work there, the first communion that they had, they only had 3 adults get baptized. They baptized something like 13 children, and the children participated as well. The chief, you know, at the beginning I talked about Chief Itakni. He was the one who went out and prayed for a white man to come and teach them how to live in this new world. And he came to that first communion, but he, at the last minute, decided he wasn't ready to get baptized. He didn't want to do it yet. And he told work Carruthers, he said, "Look, if none of the people you baptize die in the next year, then I'll get baptized next year." So as the year goes on, they are praying that none of the people who get baptized will die. But one of the little girls gets really sick. And they're all really afraid that she's going to die. And eventually, just before, like a month or so before communion is supposed to happen, she does die. In the Comanche culture, they had a terrible fear of seeing dead people. So because of that, like, they would sometimes even, like, take dying people up into the woods, like, into the mountains and just leave them there because they didn't want to see them dead. So it says, and Jenny's like, she's a little girl, okay? It says, Carothers took special care to plan Jenny's funeral so as to overcome the Indian's fear of looking on a dead face. As the pupils and parents assembled in the church, the open casket was in the front. Carothers read from the Bible and prayed. They sang the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." He invited everyone to go forward and look at her. Children and adults filed past with only hurried glances until it was Atakni's turn. He stopped and looked for a very long time. Then he said in a voice that everyone could hear, "With face like that, the way is good. The way is good." So they would often speak about the Christian, about being a Christian as going on the Jesus road, which is interesting. It's actually a biblical way of talking about it in Acts, in the book of Acts. It's called the way, the way. Well, there's a whole lot more that happens in this book. The church grows. The school grows. They have to deal with the problems of white settlement, including one of the new problems that white settlement brought was alcohol. It was like there was no alcohol on the reservation until white settlement came. One of their members is murdered. They deal with a smallpox outbreak that kills a number of people, and the place where they built their church, you know, it was out in the middle of nowhere. Eventually, it becomes just like part of town. It's not a real big town, but like a town kind of grows up near them. Cache Creek Church lasted until December of 1970, so it lasted quite a while. And I'm kind of not covering a lot of the last part. I think the first part of the book, which is really focused on how did they begin, is such a fascinating part. The last part of, I'd say the second half of the book is much more about kind of once they were established, what kind of challenges did they face? And in later years, as the work began to decline, how did they try to deal with that? And what were the challenges that they came up against? Interestingly, one of the factors that led to decline was when they first came, and for the first couple decades that they were there, there was much more openness from the Comanches about worshiping with whites. And as time went on, as you get later into the 20th century, the drive to have like a really strong tribal identity and to have like a tribal church just caused problems, and they had a hard time keeping pastors there. They had a hard time keeping peace between the Comanches and whites who would come. So I have a couple reactions as I've read this book and I've thought about it. One is, as I read their portrayal of the Comanche camps, it sounds a lot like Oswego County to me. There's a lot of poverty, a lot of rural poverty, lots of substance abuse, families that are just totally broken, many aimless men, and in many ways they are just kind of prey for anyone stronger who can come in and just do whatever they want with them, do whatever they want with their community. And very much, for many of them, very much many people in our county without God in the world. So, what does that mean for us? We very much, I think, we think of ourselves as being Americans, as living in a nation that used to be Christian, and maybe in some sense still is. But if we can look at those around us, look at our community as having this same kind of like spiritual need that they encountered when they first got to Comanche territory. I actually think that's kind of where we are. We're not far from there. So what would it look like if we think about our place in Oswego County, if we think about our surroundings more in those terms, how would that change the way that we think about our presence here in Oswego and in this county? It's also striking, I mean, they are a mission group, right? But it's amazing, reading through it, just how much time is devoted to worship, family worship, singing psalms, praying together, the preaching, just every chance they had, they were doing that. I think there's kind of a question that a lot of churches face, and it's one I think we have to continue to wrestle through, which you could... I have it in the outline here is church or mission, church with mission. Like, the idea here is, which is more important? Is it our community as a church and our life as a church here that is more important, or is it our, you know, is it our worship here and our love for one another in this church that's more important, or is it our reaching out to those who are outside the church that is more important? And the fact is that you have to have both. If we are solely focused on ourselves, then and we don't think of ourselves as being put here with a mission from God, then we can very quickly just become a social club, and then we'll fight about stuff. And, you know, and be just totally distracted. On the other hand, if we don't have a life together as a church, then what are we reaching people with? Like, what are we inviting them into, right? So that's the thing. It's very striking. Like, they did hardcore mission work, but when you see sort of the life that they had together in that mission, the way that the missionaries cared for each other, supported each other, the way that they were all working together is really, really striking. They loved each other. They cared for each other. Yes, Andy.
Is there any thought about pursuing that question further, to flesh it out some more in terms of identifying actions that we can take?
Well, funny you should ask. So first of all, we'll talk, we're going to, as usual, we'll have discussion about this next week. And the other thing is, as we get into the spring, I want us to think about all the lessons that we've done so far this fall that have been more historical focus and begin to think about, okay, what are some lessons that we can learn from this? So I'm intentionally just kind of like asking questions and kind of trying to be a little bit tantalizing. Okay. All right, we're over time, so I'll just wrap up real quick. The other thing that strikes me is how they knew that they had to reach children. They knew that in order to bring about change, they had to get to the children. And that's another thing I think we could think about. How do you interrupt a culture? How do you redirect a culture? It's through children, right? Through the children, you can reach parents and other adults. That's something to think about. I'm also really struck by this. You know, we can look back and they just worked their tails off in this mission. It was brutal work that they did. But what really strikes me, and this is something to think about, is all of their work was for the mission. Like, all of their work was for, like, either raising food for the mission, making clothing for the mission, tending to the farm that they lived on, or, you know, and all those things went to feeding and clothing the people who worked on the mission, who were teaching the children, who were sharing the gospel. All of that work was towards the mission and supporting each other. So there's, I think there's something there about, something for us to think about in terms of self-support. All right, well, I've gone way over time. Thank you for coming, and we'll get to talk about this more next week.
Thank you.